Okay.
My meeting, and we're going to discuss business combinations.
Okay, we'll.
Hold on.
So.
Oh, he's got, can you push that again and then leave? No, 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 not you. Both turn it off. Okay, no, don't touch it again, please.
Sorry. Okay, so this afternoon we're looking at business combinations and follow-up to our respective post-implementation reviews. We're going to start off looking at the section to do with definition of a business, and we're going to have Nick and Leo give some short introductions, and then we'll go into the questions about definition of business. After we've finished discussing those questions, we'll then have Michelle and Haley come to the table, and we'll do the same thing again with goodwill and impairment, that side of it. So, Nick, if I can hand over to you.
Sure. So I'm just going to give a quick background on the FASB's project on the definition of a business. So the FASB added this project for a couple reasons, the first being practice issues, which did include feedback we received in the post-implementation review on 141R. Also, as part of the feedback we received from stakeholders, we did note that while the definition is identical to the definition in IFRS today, that practice is not the same. That is, many more transactions in the U.S. are being accounted for as businesses than they are under IFRS. The second issue of why the FASB added the project relates to some of the consequential amendments in the new revenue standard, which related to the derecognition of non-financial assets, because the scope of that topic is partially driven off of the definition of a business. So as part of that, because of that, clarifying the definition was also important to that new guidance. So the board is going to address this in three phases. The first phase being clarifying the definition in topic 805. The second phase will be addressing the issues I mentioned related to the new revenue standard. And the third phase would be to explore aligning asset versus business differences, which would just take pressure off of the definition of a business in general. But so for the rest of the discussion, I'm just going to talk about phase one, because that's really where the overlap is here between the FASB and IFRS potential projects. You know, the feedback we received indicated that the definition was too broad and difficult to apply, and the main issues that were identified related to identifying the types of processes that needed to be included in the transferred set in order to be considered a business. Another major issue was considering how to evaluate whether or not market participants were capable of replacing missing elements, which people thought was quite broad and difficult to apply. And then also the definition of outputs itself was considered broad. To address these issues, we've decided on the following to date. One is to include a fair value threshold in the guidance. And so this would be kind of a screen, so that if substantially all the values in like a single asset or a group of similar assets, that really the substance of the arrangement is just purchasing this one asset versus an integrated set that's kind of all working together. So this is intended to be, said, kind of a screen, so you don't have to go through the rest of the steps in the model, and hopefully can weed out some of the transactions with other ancillary or minor items along with the asset. But the second kind of major decision was that the set must include at a minimum an input in a substantive process, and because the discussion of a substantive process is something that is new, we've also decided to include a framework to help people evaluate when that substantive process and those required minimum elements would be present. And then because this framework I mentioned focuses on what is included in the set, we thought it would be better to remove that requirement that a market evaluation of whether a market participant is capable of replacing missing elements. So right there, that takes pressure off of a couple other issues, which are the evaluation of the market participant, which people raised as a challenge, as well as what it means to be capable of. So by removing that, we took, believed that we took a lot of pressure off of those issues. And then the final major decision was to align the definition of outputs with how outputs are described in the new revenue standard, that is, you know, goods or services to customers, rather than focusing on whether or not the set is has the ability to generate a return, which was broad and doesn't, in our view, doesn't really just, you know, distinguish between an asset purchase and a business. So the memo provided had, we included a lot of the potential amendments so far, as well as a few examples. And really the goal and objective of all this is to create consistency in application, hopefully narrow the definition a little bit. And another major goal is we thought this would get us closer aligned with people who are applying IFRS, because we did focus a lot on substantive processes, and we understand that's how what's being done in practice, predominantly in practice, under IFRS as well. So with that, I mean, we are hopefully ready to be able to issue an ED in the near term. But with that, then I'll turn it over to Leo.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everybody. The objective of Agenda Paper 13A is to agree the next steps for the SB project on the definition of a business. In paragraph 8 to 10 of the paper, we report a summary of the FASB tentative agenda decisions on how to clarify the definition of a business. Then, in paragraph 11 and 12 of the paper, we report the main challenges that participants to the post-implementation review of IFRS 3 have identified when determining whether an acquisition includes a business. We have compared those decisions with the concern raising during the review of IFRS 3, and we think that FASB proposal responds to most of the challenges identified during the review of IFRS 3. In particular, we think that the guidance proposed by FASB on a substantive process in paragraph 9 and 10 of the paper would help IFRS preparers in the assessment of the relevance of processes acquired and when the entity acquired does not generate revenues. Consequently, we think that this proposal responds to the issue mentioned in paragraph 11A and 11B of the paper. We also think that the FASB tentative decision to not consider the assets acquired a business if substantially all of the fair value of the asset acquired is concentrated in a single asset could help in determining whether the acquired set of assets is not a business, and so it responds to the issue mentioned in paragraph 11B of the paper. We also support the FASB tentative decision to revise the definition of outputs and to add examples to help with the interpretation of what is considered a business. On the other hand, we note that FASB tentatively decided not to clarify the concepts of capable of and market participants, and that many participants to the post-implementation review of IFRS 3 asked the SB to clarify or change these two concepts. On the basis of this comparison, we recommend that the ISB should consider proposing changes to IFRS 3 that are the same as the FASB decision in paragraph 8A, 8C, 8E, 9, and 10 of the paper. We also recommend that the ISB should consider change or clarify the concept of capable of and market participants. We propose to bring an analysis of these matters to a future ISB meeting. We also recommended that the ISB should work towards an exposure draft rather than a discussion paper. We think that it is not necessary to publish a discussion paper because the aim of this project is not to develop a new principle, but to improve the existing definition of a business and the related application guidance. The first question that we have for you is in the cover memo in agenda paper 13. That is, do ISB members and FASB members have any question or feedback on the respective project approaches and project summaries set out in both Agenda Paper 13A and FASB Memo 15?
Okay. not sure, Leo, if this is to you or if it's to...
Oh, Russ, you were sharing, right?
Sorry.
Mary?
Russ, I'm not sure if this is a question for Leo or Nick, but I might just have been confused by talking about insurance before lunch, but in the ISB paper, Leo, you're saying in paragraph 8 that although FASB has decided to retain the concept of capable of and not to explore changes to the concept of market participant, let me focus on capable of. Nick, do you think the other, well, you're not, as I understand it, planning to interpret or provide guidance around capable of, do you think that some of the other changes you're making will reduce the pressure on capable of? And so do you think that even if capable of was raised as an issue, that the other changes you're making mean that capable of kind of goes away and doesn't have to be addressed?
Yeah, so I think the biggest concern around capable of related to that requirement when a set was missing elements, and you had to, under the current definition, evaluate whether a market participant was capable of acquiring the set of assets and activities and replacing all the missing elements and continuing to produce outputs. Mm-hmm. The market participant notion combined with capable of in that one sentence just made it appear just very broad, because some market participant out there somewhere is capable of doing something with what you acquired and continuing to produce outputs. So by removing that, I think it takes a lot of pressure off of both of those concepts, market participant and capable of.
When you say removing,
we actually deleted that in our proposed amendments, and we are going to replace that with a minimum requirement that the set have an input and substantive process. So we're actually kind of flipping the analysis into focus on, did you acquire enough to be a business, rather than could somebody replace the missing elements?
Okay. And then I had
this point, I think there was a confusion to me too, because Leo's paper said that FSB's tentative decided to not explore changes to the concept of market participant. And actually, you say we'll remove.
So there's market participant was used in a couple places in the standard. One of them being where I was just mentioning about how you evaluate a set with missing elements. There's another paragraph in there that just kind of retains a broad principle that the analysis of whether or not what you're acquiring as a business is done from a market participant standpoint. And that was in there so that you don't take into account intent. So it doesn't matter how I would use it if I bought it or how you used it. That's where we retained kind of that overall notion of market participant, but we did remove that other aspect, which was causing probably more of the problems in the analysis.
Okay. And I guess partly in terms of saying, as we think about what you're doing and whether that response, I think we have to think about whether the comments that we got in our PIR about market participants are the same comments that you got in your PIR about market participants, because I think you're responding to what you were told. And I'm not saying ours are different, but I just haven't thought through that. The other thing I was going to ask you, and it's a bit more of a micro question, and looking at the examples and, you know, coming from a perspective of fewer examples, probably better than lots of examples, I guess I was trying to challenge myself about whether this number of additional examples, you know, how they provided different insights. I think that a couple of them illustrated the same point for different industries, and while that might be helpful for an industry, I wasn't sure it really got to a different point. And especially, for example, case E. And then when I looked at case H, the acquisition of a corporate office building, paragraph 78, it says the REIT concludes that the fair value of the in-place leases are significant, and since even though they're at market value, and I just wondered if that was a typical and appropriate conclusion, because it seemed to kind of assume away one of the difficult factors, and I wasn't sure why in-place leases at market value were a significant additional asset that meant it wasn't just the building.
Yeah, so, I mean...
So that's several things about the examples all lumped together. They aren't necessarily connected.
Yeah, so it does happen. So the way that when real estate is purchased, whether or not it is in a business or an asset, you'll have, they value the building on an as-if vacant basis, mm-hmm. then they'll have an intangible asset for the in-place leases, and then there would be an off-market asset or liability there. And oftentimes we understand that there is significant value in that just in-place lease, even if it's at fair value or at market terms. I personally think of it kind of like a contractual customer relationship intangible.
Although it does have the effect that it means that anytime you buy a building with an in-place lease, it's likely, you know, that is going to be a business because of the presence of.
All it means, and I think case H, we still come to the conclusion that it's not a business. All it means is you wouldn't get through the first screen or the threshold. And because we do think there are real estate businesses, so, and the fact that there's significant revenue activities would probably tend to lead you more down the line of, we have to think about this a little bit more as whether or not it's a business. So that's why separating tangible assets and intangible assets from, like, rather than combining those to think about them together for applying this threshold, that's why I think we thought that was appropriate.
My other point about do you really bring up that many different points? I think it's just a comment rather than a please respond.
Gary?
Thank you. I'll begin by saying I like the direction both staffs are going on this, but I'll focus the question on the FASB paper, Nick, and specifically paragraph 12D about narrowing the definition of outputs, which I think is a generally think is a good way to go, but you've characterized in there in the context of the revenue standard, and you think in terms of outputs mm-hmm. within using customers. But would that imply a business has to deal with using customers? If you're vertically integrated, your customer might carry
the next
step in a process, thinking exploration, production, and oil and gas. I mean, they've got finished gasoline products that they sell to the companies. Network of gasoline stations could just as easily be sold outside. So what are you thinking in terms of?
To me, that's why that keeping that market participant concept in there is very important, because then when you would think about that those downstream activities, and if you thought about it from the market participant, they could theoretically be selling those on an outside basis, or it could be a standalone business selling it to third parties. So that's why.
So it could, in concept, it could be a business.
Yeah.
You know, because the output could be used by an end user.
Absolutely, because if you thought about a manufacturer buying their supplier and the supplier was their only customer, well, that's a business that they just bought.
I agree
right?
with the
yep.
answer.
Yep.
I just wanted to make. But yep. I was make sure you weren't cutting out, you know, downstream suppliers and something vertically yep. integrated.
Too light.
My question's quite a micro one as well, and it's on one of the examples. And I think I understand the idea in terms of looking at these groups of assets and deciding whether you've got a single group of assets or mm-hmm. more. And maybe this reflects my lack of understanding of lessor accounting under US GAAP. So. But if I was in IFRS land, then even if from a valuation perspective I might think of the value of a building on a sort of with and without lease basis,
mm-hmm.
when I got to the accounting, I think I would have either a building with an operating lease, and I'd have a building on the balance sheet, the measurement of which might in part reflect the value of the lease, but it would be the building. Or I would have a finance lease, in which case I'd have a receivable, which I would have thought would be a loan-like thing, which would be a tangible asset. So is this true for all leases, irrespective of whether they're operating or finance leases? And does it follow the accounting, or are you following sort of valuation concepts?
Well, I think in
or maybe the, you think all the, of these types of leases tend to be operating leases because it's property.
I mean, I think in that example, it's clearly an operating lease because the building is on your books, and the asset is the intangible asset rather than for. Whenever talking about the asset related to the lease, it is just really an intangible asset that
so you
that
don't
you
think
acquired.
Of it as being sort of implicit in the carrying value of the building?
Well, you could, but I think the business combination accounting is what causes the distinction.
Yeah.
I mean, I think when you add up the, if it's an at market lease, if you add up the at market lease and you add up the building that's valued without leases, I think you get to the fair value of the building.
Yeah, there's usually not goodwill in those transactions.
But it's just, but I think it's something that was done in business, am I right, in business combination accounting?
Yeah.
And so, which I don't know. I would have thought you'd get the same answer in our IFRS.
But it
know.
Comes
I
up later on the identification of intangibles. These are intangibles that people are required under the BizCom literature to identify separate and apart from the lease accounting standard.
So, but if it was a finance lease, presumably it would be on as a finance lease, yes? So this must be more operating leases where we I know you're right, actually. We do have different things going on that bring stuff on balance sheet that wouldn't otherwise be. But if it was a finance lease, it wouldn't be intangible, yeah?
I wouldn't think so.
But the basic idea is to follow whatever the accounting entries are rather than valuation as such.
Tom?
Yep.
Leonardo, I wanted to better understand your evaluation that our changes don't deal with capable of or market participant. By looking at two paragraphs in our draft standard to better understand where you're, perhaps you have the IFRS PIR gave different perspectives than ours. So I want to look at page 12 of our draft, of our memo, and in paragraph 55-5 at the bottom there. Because what originally was in the standard was that second sentence that where the market participant information was dropped. So what it said previously is a business need not include all inputs or processes of the seller used in operating that business if a market participant was capable of filling it all in. And we've gotten rid of the need to think about market participants filling in the full inputs and processes to create outputs or capability of outputs, and replaced it with the sentence below that says you no longer have to think about what market participants are doing. What you need to do is think about whether or not you have, if there's no output, the right combination of inputs and substantive processes, or if there is output, a lesser notion of inputs and substantive processes, such that you don't have to think about what a market participant could fill in whatsoever. So that's one set of issues we addressed there. And I sort of had the reaction when I read your memo that perhaps our changes addressed capable of and market participants by changing the focus to the inputs, processes, and outputs that's available in the business. But yet, in the next page, on the top of the on page 14, there is a market participant notion in paragraph 55-8 still. But it only says is, to Gary's point, does the entity acquiring the business based on whether there is sufficient inputs, processes, and outputs, or maybe not outputs, but significant in acquiring it, do they plan on operating it as a business or not? And the only way the market participant comes into play there is if they don't plan on it, but they could. And that's the only and capable of. Were there, so I'm trying to understand what the issues are about a capable and market participant that you heard in your PIR, and were they more about this second application or more about the first? Because if it's the first, I thought we may have addressed the issues.
Yes. First of all, I think when I read the detail of your amendment, I think that I think you have already addressed also these two concepts. Regarding the feedback that we received during the post-implementation review regarding capable of, especially from oil and gas industry, extractive industry, they say every asset is capable of producing an output. And so they say this is too general, too broad. This is the main feedback that we receive. Regarding market participant approach, we receive two kinds of feedback. The first one is to clarify what does it mean market participant. They say it's a term that is not defined under FRS. The second comment that we received is a bit different, and they say a business can be a business for some market participant, but cannot be a business for another market participant. And so they ask, maybe I have to consider the intention of the acquirer. This is the second main comment that we received. So at the end, reading your proposal, I think that even though not in a direct way, but in an indirect way, you have addressed this concern. This is my personal view.
Okay. I came to that same conclusion. I was just curious. Market participants bolded in ours. Is our definition linked to the fair value measurement market participant
it
definition?
Is. It is.
But it's not in IFRS. You said there's not a definition of market participant in IFRS 3. It's not linked to the definition of market participant that you have in IFRS 13?
That would be a glossary, maybe.
Daryl wants to enter this point.
Yeah, I was just going to interject. Tom, I think perhaps a way to think about the capable of and what we took out versus what we kept, at least in my mind, is that what we took out was the notion of a market participant being capable of producing an output with what they purchased. Now we're saying instead you have to purchase a substantive process and an output. Now the question is the market participant capable of running that as a business? So I think it's, we kept that second capable of, but it's not whether you're capable of producing an output, because I think that part that we took out is what was causing the broadness of the interpretation.
Yeah, I thought so too. That's, and I think that's what Leonardo said too.
Thank you. On paragraph 59-9A on page 14, you introduced a new screen of fair value kind of model to classify this is a business or mm-hmm. not. But I'm concerning about this 9A. We are considering, or we are not considering a business or not, even if it's a really a kind of proper business in economic sense, but we are assuming all our substantial fair value is just concentrated on the one single tangible asset. In that case, regardless of what this is, a real estate of the business or not, we are assuming this is another business. So, and go on and go on. Is that my understanding is right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, so for the most part, we understand. This used to be a concept that was in U.S. GAAP back before Statement 141R. So for the most part, when you're acquiring just one thing or there's a couple minor things, the transactions we've been presented with and we've encountered in our outreach, they probably, a lot of them might not meet the definition of a business either way. There is the potential that something could be a clear business, but we think that would be a rare situation that you encounter, because most of the times business would have other assets, they would have processes, they would have goodwill, they would have things like that that would prevent you from meeting the threshold. And that's also why we included the guidance in 9C of things you couldn't combine together, because we didn't want this to be applied too broadly so that nothing met the definition of a business anymore. We wanted it to be kind of a practical but sufficiently narrow analysis.
I agree. This is a very convenient, practical, expedient,
right,
maybe to differentiate whether this is business or not. But I would like to maybe ask you, maybe in the basic conclusion, is it conceptually, you know, we are not differentiating the business or not, but we are providing a kind of some kind of practical thing, you know, because in the case of U.S., you know, real estate industry has some problems in applying for the definition of business. So that's what we invented. You invented this kind of a very good idea. These idea, screening idea, is applied in the first, second examples in your paper. So it's quite strong, efficient, effective way. So we need a kind of a, some kind of clear explanation. This is a, not a conceptual issue, but we are providing a kind of a practical issue solution to market. So we need to be in a kind of a caution on this requirement.
Okay. I think that's a good. I completely understand what you're saying. That's good advice. Awegu?
You ask us to answer question two, but I feel from beginning it's very hard. The capable of market participants are two of the popular fundamental concepts. I don't think we have ever defined a conceptual level or in any particular standards. So therefore, you know, you recommend consider changing or classifying the concept. Firstly, I'm not sure whether we really want to, you know, classify, change the concept itself, or as Tom or Daryl just said, it's actually change not the capable and market participant, the two term per se, to change some of the sentence or words in the whole paragraph. Firstly, I think you should be very clear. And secondly, if you propose to change or clarify, I have some worry, because we use the term so everywhere that next time in another standard, people say it, you know, it's not clear enough. We face problem. Please give, you know, clarification about capable of and market participants. Then we have different definition of market participants and capable of in different standards. And gradually it will be hard for us to reconcile ourselves. So I'm not sure exactly what do you mean, change and clarify the two concepts. You ask us to ask question whether we agree with you to do so. It seems, you know, not so clear and even not, you know, appropriate to do so, in my view.
We are only proposing to bring an analysis to a future ISB meeting on this topic. And then at the end of this analysis, we can recommend to change or not to change. This is my recommendation for now.
But my understanding from what Tom said is not change these two terms per se. Change some part of the word in the whole sentence. I'm right, Tom?
I think the distinction is, so we, when we had our post-implementation review, it was quite clear in a lot of our minds that the use of an interpretation of a business was much broader in the U.S. than it was outside the U.S., even though you had the same words. So we undertook a project to get to what we thought was a more reasonable interpretation of the definition of a business. So we're presenting that to you. I think what your staff is asking you is, do you want to consider this analysis at a future meeting? And if that meeting is successful, I think the staff's also recommending that you go directly to an exposure doc. I don't think they're asking you to agree with the FASB's definition at this point or agree to take out capable. Is that right?
Exactly.
So they just, they're asking you, do you want to read another memo on it? Okay, Philippe?
Yeah, I think it's a bit too early to opine on the details of the proposals. We have to consider and think and pause a little bit, but I think I like the overall direction of travel, both by FASB on our side. Seems to me it is convergent. It seems to me it should be helpful in reducing some of the pressure on the definition of the business. So I think we should go on and consider and give you the go ahead and say yes, bring it back. I have a consequential question. If a deal fails the definition of a business deal because one of the ingredients is missing, then it becomes an asset deal, right? Okay. Are you planning to modify in any way the accounting for an asset deal? Say, take the example of a building which has some leases in place. So you acquire for a certain price a combination of building and leases. And that would maybe fail the definition of business because there is no workforce in place, no unique process, so it would be an asset deal, maybe, I understand the example. Then would the accounting for that pool be disaggregated into the building itself and the leases as an intangible asset, or would you recognize only one single asset?
So in the real estate example anyway, I think they have those lease assets on the books regardless of it's a business or an asset. Some of the key differences, I think the main difference there would be transaction costs and whether or not those are expensed or capitalized. Some of the other major differences are, you know, between the accounting models are contingent consideration, IPR&D in the pharma industry or in technology. So there are a handful of fairly significant and can be material accounting differences. I don't think whether or not you have a lease intangible is one of them. And we are, this project, when it was added and the board directed us how to proceed, they said, first, let's try to clarify the definition and kind of help take care of practice issues and then explore aligning asset versus business differences. So there really is no difference.
Could I just check? I think one basic point that Philippe was checking is if you get caught by that first screen that says substantially all the value is in an asset or a group of similar assets, having reached that conclusion, therefore doing asset acquisition accounting, you would account for everything you acquired and not be forced to put all the value into just the recognition of the item that was substantially all. If there were other things that gave value, you still would account for them the way you account for them. Right. You aren't forced to say, pretend it's you only acquired that asset.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Let me clarify. Yeah. If I have an acquisition for $100 million, of which 99 clearly can be attributed to the value of that building, which has a number of leases in place. So it's clearly an asset deal, not a business combination. Then the value of the asset, $99 million plus maybe $1 million, whatever, is composed of the building empty plus the value of the leases. Are you going to think of saying, well, there is a value of the building without the leases for $60 million plus the implicit value of the leases in place for $39-40 million?
I think you're asking an ordering question, which in essence, I think the answer to your question is the building would be at 60, the in-place leases would be 40, and it would not pass this threshold because of that. So what you do is you first determine what are the types of assets in the item to determine if substantially if you meet the substantially fair value test. In this case, you probably would not.
But even if you don't meet that test, you still have to evaluate whether the combination of inputs, processes, and capable outputs qualify as a business.
Right, turning fully.
You likely would determine it's not a business in that scenario. You just have more work to do to determine that than you would have had you passed the threshold.
But turning Philippe's example around, instead of 60-40, if your numbers had been, let's say, 90-10, you know, 90 the empty building and 10 the leases, then you might conclude that substantially all is that. And then I think the question is, would you then account separately for the building and the 10 of?
You would. You do normal asset accounting.
Right. Normal asset accounting,
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Tomorrow?
In both the circumstances.
I think the question is similar to Ehul's, and it's much more in processes. The questions here, 1, 2, 3, they're quite similar to the questions on paper 13A for the ISP. And 13A goes a little bit further, asking if we do agree to explore the changing concepts of capable of and market participants. I am okay with the general process, and I appreciate Russ' clarification on the objectives of clarifying. I think convergence is extremely important in projects that we are convergent.
at this moment. So continue to be converted is, to me, is quite important. It's just really a process here. I think that the questions to us, the ISB, the way they are posed, they go beyond what we could comfortably answer right now. So I'm focusing on the consider word. So of course, I like the idea, I like the direction, I strongly support the convergence, and yes, I do support considering this. Because as is stated, and the discussion has showed, FASB has completed this deliberation, so they are well ahead of us, I would say, particularly in the when it comes to examples and concepts. And FASB is planning to publish an ED late Q3, so late Q3 will be next week, or early Q4 will be 2 weeks from here. So just to stress, particularly for me to be comfortable in saying yes to this, and for outsiders to understand what we are, yeah. If we do agree, what we are agreeing is that with, in my view, a support to keep convergent standards and support to explore exactly the same points as explored by the FASB and as soon as possible, right? Because in order to somewhat have an exposure draft aligned with the FASB as much as possible, of course it won't be at the same Q3 or Q4, but to have a beneficial mutual discussion in the future about this. So I hope we can keep convergence at the end of the both exposure drafts. Is that right?
Yes, if you're in agreement, we'd expect to bring your paper in October that would ask you those technical decisions for progressing to an exposure draft.
And this applies to the other papers that are here already, just not to keep repeating the same discussion.
Siobhan and Stephen, are you okay?
I was going to ask about this alignment of asset accounting and business combination accounting, which I think somebody else asked earlier. But would we have any plans to look at that?
We do identify that. That was part of the feedback that we got in our business combinations review. We identify that as being something that we think should be done in sort of the medium to long term, because it's about narrowing those differences between business combination accounting and asset accounting. And for us, for IFRS, one of the key differences is to do with deferred tax. Now, my understanding is US GAAP doesn't have that same difference, but for us, it's all about the application or not of the initial recognition exception when you acquire an asset that has a temporary difference on day one. And so we need to be able to work on that first before we could then address what I would see as one of the big differences between asset accounting and business accounting.
And that's long term because it's difficult.
We've got a separate research project on income tax accounting, and so I would say we should be looking to see how we can progress that first to then come up behind that with looking at this.
Yeah, Jim.
There was some on our board, and appreciate that we had the immediate problem of what is a business, but really don't think it should be all that important, because if the differences didn't exist, then it's not particularly important whether it's a business or not. I think we have more differences in terms of the accounting outcome, contingent consideration, perhaps comes up in our PIR a little bit more. So if you have contingent payments, there's a model for business, a model for asset. Acquisition costs, a handful of others, but that is our phase three.
Hans, when I look at the questions that the staff's asked, I'm sensitive to most relate to the ISB and not the FASB. So, do you want me to ask them, or do you want to, or do you think you have?
Move on to the next subject. I think we have to jump on that as well. Yeah.
So. Move on to goodwill?
Yeah.
You have what you need? Okay, great.
Well, is the ISB in agreement for us to come back with the technical analysis and proposals going in the same direction as FASB, and we'll expect it to come back to the next meeting.
Yes.
Okay.
Voting at this meeting, so. But you, yes.
Technical question.
I'll go first. So it's agenda paper 13B. Basically, the ISB paper is quite a high level proposal of how we would propose to address the research project. We're proposing to cover the three interrelated topics on a research agenda in three steps. And that's firstly the identification and measurement of intangible assets, and then the subsequent accounting for goodwill, and then looking to improve the impairment test in IAS 36 for goodwill and other non-current assets. We're recommending working towards a discussion paper which covers all of the three topics together. This is because we think the interrelationship between the three topics makes it difficult for us to develop a proposal for one topic without understanding how this would affect views on the other topics, views of respondents on the other topics. And we also think there are a number of approaches that we could consider to addressing the issues suggested in paragraph 8 of the agenda paper. Also, some of the approaches that the staff have suggested in paragraph 8 haven't formally been discussed by the ISB, for example, the direct write-off of goodwill or considering addressing components of goodwill. So we think a discussion paper is important in order to get detailed feedback on the interaction of the approaches, particularly if we're considering some of the new approaches. Now, we think, given the work that we've done in the post-implementation review and also the work that's been performed by the FASB and also other organisations, that a discussion paper could be developed within 12 months. Now I'll pass over to Hadi before we have an open discussion.
I'd like to start by going over the status of the FASB's current project on identifiable intangible assets in a business combination for public business entities and not-for-profits, which is FASB Memo Number 2 and ISB Memo 13D in your materials. As a bit of background, the FASB project resulted from a private company council, or the PCC's, decision and the subsequent board ratification of an electable alternative for private companies on this topic. That project was driven by private company stakeholder feedback that the benefits of recognizing and measuring certain identifiable intangible assets weren't justified by the costs that private companies incurred to value those. And so the FASB decided, when they endorsed that decision, to add it to their technical agenda as well. Going to focus the discussion of our outreach and feedback received just on the public business entity side, I think not the nonprofits, which wouldn't necessarily be relevant for this joint meeting. The results of the post-implementation review of FASB Statement 141R in business combinations indicated that both private companies and public entities, which generally was smaller public entities, found the measurement of acquired intangibles to be complex and costly. So the FASB staff performed some additional outreach and research to further vet those concerns as outlined in paragraphs 10 through 17 in the board memo. The key differences noted between the private company considerations and the public business entities were that for public business entities, users preferred the recognition and measurement provisions in current GAAP because they generally don't have the same access to management, and they rely a lot on what's in the financial statements to make decisions. And then also, unlike private companies, preparers of public business entity financial statements didn't consider the valuation of acquired intangible assets to be a significant cost in a business combination. Based on the outreach that was performed, we presented views to the board in January of 2014 as options for the accounting for acquired intangible assets, and the board is still considering those options in our outreach. There have been no decisions made at this point. The three alternatives that were presented were the first, view A, to subsume all acquired intangible assets into goodwill and recognize no intangible assets in a business combination. Ultimately, that approach wasn't accepted by the PCC for private companies, and the board has asked us to focus more on the customer-related intangibles and non-competition agreements for the intangible assets that we focus the project on, which is view B. It was initially presented to the board as a principle that only intangibles that are capable of being sold or licensed independently from other assets of the business would be recognized separately. That view was further refined into four subviews for the private company alternative, and those are outlined in paragraph 20 in the memo. The PCC alternative that was ultimately selected narrowed that principle to specify that non-competition agreements would not be recognized separately, and customer-related intangibles would only be recognized to the extent they are capable of being sold or licensed independently. And then the various iterations of view B in those sub-issues, or those separate sub-views, reflect the thoughts that the treatment lines up with the accounting for an acquired assembled workforce, and that those types of assets can be difficult to value and potentially less useful to users. The last view, view C, is simply to make no changes to current GAAP for public business entities, and that would leave the potential for inconsistency in U.S. GAAP for between public and private entities, but it acknowledges the sort of divergent feedback that we got from the stakeholders of each of those. And you know, in a world increasingly focused on the more intangible aspects of business, many public business entity users feel that taking away any of that limited information that they get on intangible assets at this point would be somewhat detrimental to financial reporting. That sums up the intangible assets project. I'm going to also talk about our project on accounting for goodwill for public business entities and not-for-profits, again, focusing on public business entities. This is the other memo, which is FASB Memo 6 and IASB Memo 13E. Similar to the intangibles project, it was added to the FASB's technical agenda as a result of a PCC project to develop an alternative for private companies. That project was also driven by concerns in the private sector about the subsequent accounting for goodwill being too costly and complex. A little bit different than the intangibles project is that we also have gotten feedback from public business entities in this case that they struggle with the current impairment model for goodwill and desire a change for that as well. Going back to when FASB Statement 142 was issued, there were concerns at that point about the cost and complexity of the impairment model. Subsequent to that, the FASB did address that concern somewhat with the qualitative screen that was introduced, allowing companies to do a qualitative analysis that if they passed, they didn't have to move into the quantitative steps that were in 142. The intention of that was to alleviate some of those concerns, but it has yet to be fully embraced by preparers. In the U.S., there have been some recent surveys that show that its use is increasing. There's some concern with the current regulatory environment and with auditors and the amount of information that they require that may not make it as effective as once thought or as effective at reducing the cost. We did receive mixed views from both users and preparers as to what the best model is, and in light of those mixed feedback, it is somewhat difficult to figure out what the best approach is. We presented four alternatives to the board that all have several sub-issues that would also need to be addressed. And again, with these, they've been presented to the board. No decisions have been made by the board at this point. But the first view is the model selected by the PCC, which is a combination of several of the other views, so I'm not going to go into details on that. The second view is to amortize goodwill, which paragraph 51 in the board memo describes some of the sub-issues that would also need to be addressed if that was the election made. And I think many see that amortizing goodwill is a would be a further simplification of the accounting for goodwill, and it would likely be paired with a simpler impairment test as well. The additional issues that have been identified could potentially introduce some additional complexity into that, into the amortization model. VC is the direct write-off of goodwill, and that's whether it's through a charge to net income, comprehensive income, or directly to equity. Many proponents believe that would greatly simplify the accounting and remove essentially all the costs associated with the subsequent accounting of goodwill. But that opponents think there could be some negative consequences and unintended, unfounded negative perceptions if you wrote everything off at you know, day one. And also detrimental effects on ratios and things like that. If the write-off's also to OCI or equity, there could be some additional considerations that make it less simple. And then the last view is an option to simplify the current impairment test, and there are a number of ways that you could do that. U.S. GAAP, this is an area also that is not as converged with IFRS, so U.S. GAAP has a two-step impairment test currently at the reporting unit level, and it has to be done annually on the same date every year. So a possible simplification for us would be to remove step two of the impairment test, which that requires a hypothetical purchase price allocation to the assets and liabilities. It's very, you know, often seen as very complex and costly, and you know, generally is not favored by a lot of the preparers that have to do it, I think. So that is one way. Additionally, you could, which also would converge a little bit more as far as there only being a one-step impairment test under IFRS. So additional things that could be done is the changing the level at which the impairment test is done from a reporting unit to something higher, maybe even up to the entity level, and also addressing the date at which you have to perform it, whether it's based on triggering events or you still have to perform it every year. So most stakeholders are generally favorable towards simplifying impairment, but they often disagree on the exact details of applying that approach. So with that, we'll go to question four that's in the cover memo, and that is, you know, do the ISB members and FASB members have any questions or feedback on the project approaches and project summaries that were set out both in the ISB paper and the FASB paper?
Yeah. A general question. Approach seemed to be quite distinct. So our staff is proposing a discussion paper to explore more. Yours is already, I understand, since 2013 in the technical agenda. So you've gone a long way in until these four alternatives, view A to view D. So, I'm somewhat, and this is much more to our staff maybe, I'm somewhat sympathetic to the ASA feedback that we got in March 2014, that it might not be the case for us to explore alternatives in a discussion paper, and using the feedback that we already had in the post-implementation review, and maybe together with the experience that you are exploring the U.S., I would like to hear more, and you don't have much here about the qualitative assessment, and I understand it's quite new. I think this might be an alternative for keeping the requirements today, but adding a qualitative, it might be a way to find a balanced outcome that would satisfy the majority. No one will never reach a total agreement on that. So the question is maybe much more to our staff. What would you expect to explore in a discussion paper and get from the discussion paper that we don't have today?
I think our reasons for considering a discussion paper approach would be really if we're bringing in sort of newer considerations. So if we were considering things like writing off goodwill, considering looking at components of goodwill, and also the fact that we feel there's an interrelation with if we're starting to look at what intangible assets should be recognised and measured, there would be a knock-on effect then on the composition of goodwill and hence the subsequent accounting for goodwill. And so we think those interrelations and also the possibility of considering those new approaches would be best considered in a discussion paper. Although we have been discussing, there was also the suggestion that we could pursue an exposure draft route for some of the impairment issues, because perhaps some of those could be addressed separately from the interrelation between the intangibles and the goodwill, and perhaps we could proceed to an exposure draft on that part. Would also be that option.
But none of these are new considerations. I mean, they've all been considered. Mm-hmm. Nothing new in these papers at all.
Oh, some are new. Some are new. Some are new. Yes.
I had never seen the distinction of separating various aspects of goodwill and having different amortization periods of goodwill. That was the one thing I'd seen that was new. But I don't know how serious you might be about considering that. That was just
you're going directly to an exposure job.
That is the project plan, but you never know. Right? Mm-hmm. So, Daryl?
So that aspect of potentially looking at the components of goodwill is what I was going to ask about, Michelle, because from the FASB point of view, really one of the major premises under which we've even begun to look at goodwill is consistent feedback, for the most part, that we've gotten about the lack of relevance of goodwill and the accounting for it. Now, obviously, it's not unanimous, but have been pretty strong consensus around that. And so with that sort of as a backdrop, then, you know, the consideration that you would further break down goodwill into its components seems, you know, even more irrelevant than that. And so I guess the question that I had for you was there some feedback that the ISB staff has received from its stakeholders that would indicate that goodwill has more relevancy for them than perhaps what we've been understanding from our stakeholders?
I think what we were really considering by the component approach was merely more just whether, if we were to go down discussion paper route, whether we could just consider whether there are other routes other than pure early impairment or amortizing, whether there was a more smarter way of accounting for goodwill. I think that was more, we haven't at the staff level developed this idea. It was just considering whether there are other approaches we consider other than amortization.
So more just under the universe of possible ways we could go, this might be one.
Being as both methods have obviously got their drawbacks.
Yeah. I mean, we know that there are obviously these different elements within goodwill. We know things, you know, some things like assembled workforce, for example, or synergies. There's also a residual element as well. So there are these different strands to it. So would it actually provide more useful information if we were to look to the more granular level?
Yeah, so I think we would all readily understand and agree that goodwill is made up of various components. The question would be, you know, would there be value in breaking it down further if, when combined, it's not relevant?
It is another way of asking the question, in effect, why did you pay that premium above all this stuff that we're accounting for? It's not trying to identify specifically, oh, you will always account for workforce in place or other things, but it's trying to get at that question that investors always ask, why did you pay that additional premium above book value? And there are quite often some excellent reasons for it, but we don't capture that in accounting today.
Hugh, did you want to get down this?
Yeah, just a slightly different angle on this question of relevance and intangibles. We have our agenda consultation out right now. And one of the things we're beginning to hear is to do with the relevance of IFRS. And one of the things people quote is the difference between book value and market value. And the big difference is intangibles. I suspect we're not going to go around fair valuing all these intangibles, but we maybe need to think about walking towards this issue and figuring out what it all means.
Tom?
Thank you. ISB is going to change the meaning of research phase and the standard setting phase. So we try to increase research phase more, so that once we go into the standard setting phase, we do not re-expose. So the EDs should be quite narrowed down. So with this concept, maybe a discussion paper could be possible. However, we already have a lot of discussion, and also FASB has done lots of research and options. The one option we didn't really discuss in our board is about view C, especially. View C is to write off or to charge it to the equity. And I think paragraph 53 of 11D is really interesting, whether or not goodwill is asset. And according to IFRS 3, it is clearly said that goodwill asset, but we are going to change our conceptual framework. In that conceptual framework, we are saying is asset is a future economic benefit, and economic benefit is a kind of bundle of right. So a question is whether the goodwill is something like a right or not. Such kind of question is very viable question. And also, as Hao pointed out, whenever we acquire company, we pay more than net asset. So somehow it's an overpayment. So we don't know how much is the overpayment and how much is the goodwill. So if it's definitely goodwill or intangible asset, then they may be asset. However, if it's real pure overpayment, definitely it's not an asset. So therefore, I think kind of approach like a discernible element approach. Say, for example, if we have a rebuttable presumption, if we cannot prove the discernible element in the in your payment, then residual would be assumed to be overpayment. So in that case, so like view C, we can charge it directly to the expense or equity. And then discernible element can be amortized based on the definite life. Actually, that one of the difficulty of the identifiable intangible asset is whether or not it's an identifiable intangible asset with finite life or indefinite life. That is more important. And actually, in my previous life, that was the biggest question because it affects profit and loss directly. And also, it has a kind of strange incentives not to identify definite life, because finite life. Because if you prove it, then you would charge amortized cost. And if you did nothing, then you can leave it as something like indefinite, intangible, so that you wouldn't charge any amortized. So such incentive, that reversed incentive, was in practice. That was my headache in my previous life. So therefore, if we ask preparers to prove a discernible element first, and if you fail to prove, you have to charge it to the equity via profit or loss or directly. Such kind of way is possible. So therefore, I think not only simply just amortized or not amortized, we can have a little bit broader idea. So in this sense, I support kind of discussion paper.
Larry?
So I'm going to resort back to my usual blunt self.
I'll do the political spin.
I mean, the major purpose of this meeting for the two respective boards is to figure out what direction each of us is going to go, and whether we try to stay in sync or whether we one of us accelerates. So I have a few questions. First of all, if you go the DP route, how long do you think it will take? Because to me, it looks like at least a 3-year project. When will the decision be made by you all as to whether you go DP, ED, or have a project at all? Because part of the problem that we have is, and I realize it's our problem, it's not your problem, but we already have a lack of convergence within the U.S. because we have the PCC alternative that's out there, et cetera. And it's something that we have to live with. And some of us, when we talk about convergence, we talk about it from the perspective, well, do we want convergence within the U.S., or do we want convergence with IFRS? And that's what we're struggling with. And quite frankly, you know, we've been waiting for over a year now to figure out what you all are going to do, and therefore, you know, some of us were a little disappointed that we heard that the staff recommendation was to go DP, although I'm I'm glad to hear some of the comments of the board members that are questioning, you know, gee, what is it that we really don't know about this? And in terms of a project plan and how we go forward, if you want to consider not doing a DP, look at the process that we just use for derivatives, okay? We both have followed a process where effectively we look at issues and we build on our decisions. We make a decision here and then we build on it and we build on it, et cetera. The process we used in the last less than a year on derivatives was we discussed concepts and different issues and got board input and board leanings, let's say, but made no decisions all along the way. And then, as a result of that, the staff said, based upon what they heard the board say at the during the discussions of various issues, it appears as if the bucket of alternatives really narrows down to this or this, and it's, you know, some alternatives within that. And some of us were fearful that that meeting was going to take 4 or 5 hours, but in fact, I think we got through it in less than an hour and a half. And it's just something to look at, because I think these projects, goodwill, intangibles, possibly impairment, are very susceptible to that type of an approach, because issues tend to be interdependent. So, but in terms of my question, probably the most important thing is when do you plan on bringing this to the board to make a decision as to whether you go DP or what have you?
One of the issues we were discussing today, one of the questions today is to ask the ISB if they would like to proceed with the discussion paper.
Yeah, but okay. Is that something that we're going to decide in this meeting?
No. Maybe not.
Can we say next month?
Huh?
Yeah, I think we could bring it to
about
that.
Any of this.
Yeah.
Yes.
In technical sense. How can we make a decision
now
about the
basis to decide?
We have an agenda consultation.
But we can take that decision soon.
So perhaps a better articulation of the question is do you think you'd be in a position to decide prior to compiling the comments from the agenda consultation? I recognize this is within the agenda consultations clearly. Do you think you would need to pause and wait for that? Do you think this is something that you could resolve in the October, November time?
The only thing one can say is we know for sure from some of our outreach already that people will tell us that we should go to standard setting on this.
We are following the PIR and can have a logical end that we take decisions. So I don't see why we would have to wait for an agenda consultation.
I would say that we already have a very good idea of what the issues are through the post implementation review. So it's not a case of gathering more information about the issues. It's about developing the accounting model response to that. And that's the thing that I think, depending on how that develops, would determine, in my mind, whether the DP or the ED route would be the way to go.
So how long do you think it would take to develop that? I mean, Stephen says there hasn't been any. Are we talking one meeting or three meetings before, or you're not sure this time?
How long did it take to you to discuss and reach the four models, roughly?
Every weekly meeting. You meet each week.
In fairness, we've been talking about the same model for a while now, uh-huh. And we've developed those models fairly quickly.
Okay.
It's just, I guess, additional outreach that we've done and perhaps the private company council activities that have impacted that.
By the way, we also have internal divergence between IFRS for SMEs, which has amortization for the sake of simplicity, mm-hmm. and our own. And if you, that's why we have IFRS for SMEs. That's why you have a different gap.
Right.
So that we don't see as a problem.
The one is the simplified.
Talking to a board member who does see that as a problem.
Okay, let's get Gary.
That's why you have two different gaps. Otherwise, you shouldn't have two different gaps.
Thank you. I'm Russ. I'm looking at paragraph 6 of paper 13B. And despite what I told Michelle yesterday, I've changed my opinion slightly after this discussion, but not a lot. As I look at, think of the role of our research project, it's supposed to be evidence-based work. And if out of the PIR and other feedback we've gotten, your work, I mean, if we don't have enough knowledge to go direct, I think, to start working towards an ED on the first two issues, which are rated high, I don't know when you ever would. I mean, there's only so many answers that can possibly work in the norm here, and everything we've been told for 2 years when we started the PIR is these are big-time problems. So I don't know how much more we need to know. And there's not it's a very finite list of possible answers, and we know what those are, too. I think, Larry, I think to your question about how long would it take to get us if you went a DP route, just using sort of normal setbacks and lead times, I mean, my estimate would be you would not have a required effective date for probably 5 to 6 years. I mean, if your DP goes out late next year, you wait the next year getting feedback and analyze it, then you go to an ED, you're looking at a final standard early 19, allowing perhaps 2 years normal lead time to make it required effectiveness. Granted, I think typically we allow early adoption. I mean, that's just my, you know, looking at the calendar. I think, unlike a lot of the projects that we do here, this one doesn't touch customers or employees or there's implications, you know, outside. This is corporate staff work for M&A type accounting. So we're talking about, so it's a limit, you know, so you don't have to worry about, I got to change my customer contracts or I got to change the benefit plans or whatever. So I look to the third thing here, identification and measurement of other intangibles, medium high. I actually wouldn't object to that being a separate project, being a discussion paper focused. But it wasn't rated in the top category of needs out of the PIR. And but just a few things in here. Right now, you know, we have enough problem, you know, with some of the intangibles that you do identify and how do you test them and what the amortization life is and so on. And I think, you know, although, yes, there are synergies, there are, you know, with customer relationships and all these other things that might come into it, but to me, they're just ways of subdividing goodwill to amortize a piece of it. And in one of the ways they would probably get amortized, if you think of how in mine and Tox's former life, you know, would be it probably is discounted cash flows, discounted cash flow methods off projected cash flows. And tomorrow we're going to discuss a paper on discount rates that says there's about 20 different discount rates in there. It's unclear when and how you'd use them. So even if you went that route, I think you'd have to deal with present values first, you know, at least using our own work. And likewise, I think we'd probably give rise to another cottage industry, how to measure in these things. And this is, I mean, if measuring the intangibles we do today, customers, is an art form, these get, the only reason we're not measuring these things today because they're harder to measure than what we do measure it in it. So I support for the first two here, proceeding to a ED. I think, you know, we can explore some of the alternatives as part of work to an ED, because again, I think it's finite and they're known. And then just lastly, I think in the US, the qualitative tests, when the FASB enabled it, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, I early adopted it like the day it came out, and it did not catch on. I think it was because it wasn't spreadsheets and numbers that you could tick and tie. You know, basically you're auditing a lengthy memo, you know, and it didn't catch on. I would hope it does, and actually I wouldn't mind if we put that as one of our steps, too. So.
Tom.
Falling over. I want to build sort of off where Larry is, just to let you sort of know where we're at. It's almost 2 years since we started this, and we sort of been waiting and waiting to see what's happening on your side for convergence purposes. when we initially discussed it, I don't think we spent a lot of time on separating or not recognizing identifiable intangibles, and I don't know that we did a major straw vote on that. But it is only that issue that I see that could cause the need for DP. Because if you don't recognize a lot of identifiable intangibles and subsume them in goodwill, it's then that I think that it becomes more likely you think about components. Because otherwise, what we've got in our business combination guidance is a requirement to recognize everything that you can identify. And the things that you don't are left over goodwill. If that's the case, it's hard for me to say that there's components of an unidentifiable, non-recognizable item. And so if we were, I think the beginning conversation is, if we were to decide in the public company environment not to change that, much of the complication in your DP would go away. Because I don't think there would be any real demand for thinking about componentizing goodwill there, and some having a useful life, some having an indefinite life. And frankly speaking, that would be my vote if we voted at it for public companies. Because what we heard for both in private companies and public companies are they're not interested in all the identifiable intangibles that come out of our business combination guidance. But they are interested in the ones that matter most in the business combination. And the ones that matter most vary on the business combination. And so you can't select the one or two not to identify without losing some information, at least in the public company environment. In the private company environment, I think the PCC was emphasizing cost more, and some of the board members ratified that, in part because you have access to management that if it's not recognized, you could get some information on the thing that's most important from them directly. But in a public company environment, you can't do that. So if we take that off the table, and if we were to decide, big if, capital I, capital F, that we weren't going to do anything about changing identifiable intangibles, I think what we've got going forward is things that are issues that are very, very well known and researched over time. That is, how do you account for goodwill? And should you be amortizing it? How should you be impairing it? Not only have we done research, but the Italians and the Japanese and FRAG have supplied much, much research and a lot of input about what would happen from that basis. Now, that doesn't mean that you don't want to go forward there, but we decided way back when we had a straw vote on this, many of us thought that goodwill didn't really meet the definition of an asset because it can't be sold separately in the business. Perhaps we could argue conceptually to write it all off, but we sort of made a decision that that's not going to fly. If people buying businesses and having to write it all off is going to be getting extreme resistance from stakeholders, extreme. And so we were deciding between two approaches, simplify impairment only or amortize and simplified impairment. And at that time, we voted 4 for just simplifying impairment and 3 to amortize and simplify impairment. But many of us have heard different things from the Italians, the Japanese, the Europeans, et cetera, to make that an open conversation at least. And to recognize that goodwill that's recognized as externally acquired goodwill, that what we do in the impairment test now is compare it against both externally acquired and internally developed, and maybe that's not a real fair comparison, and so amortization is at least conceptually something to think about. But we've been waiting 2 years or more, and I think that it's going to be hard for us to step down if you're not going to be in the game for a year and a half from now.
Philippe?
Thanks. Well, I will address paper 13B first, and then I have a question for the two teams. Regarding paper 13B, it seems to me that it's probably a very complete list of questions that could be asked, except for one, and that would be my second point. Now, you are asking us to make a decision today whether to go to an ED or DP. I think that really depends very much on whether we want to table all those questions or only a few of them. Jan pointed to the fact that we know the problems. We have already had a lot of discussions on step one, maybe step three, but step two, there are some very new concepts about componentization of the goodwill. And that if we want to include this kind of question, I think we have to go to a discussion paper. If we say, no, we don't go that far, we limit ourselves to some improvement, then maybe an idea is possible. So I think we need to have a in-depth, and it's a bit short today, in-depth discussion at the ISB table to make that decision. So today is too early. And as Tom said, if we want to cover the three aspects, they are pretty much interrelated, because what you move out of intangibles and take to goodwill create new questions for goodwill. The point I wanted to ask, which is, in my opinion, not covered or not alluded to in the two papers, is what if we made the difference between a goodwill paid in cash or a goodwill paid in the form of issuing new shares from the acquiring entity? Would that be an element to consider about the subsequent accounting for the goodwill? Let me explain it. The only way I can today recognize my internally generated goodwill or my unrecognized intangibles is to do a business transaction, business combination paid in shares. Because the consideration paid that will result in the goodwill I account for includes my internally generated unrecognized goodwill. Then it's the only way I can put on my balance sheet my so far unrecognized goodwill or intangibles. Is that a consideration? And this is quite different from a cash, pure cash transaction. Because in a pure cash transaction, you only pay the price of the target. You don't add to it some form of your own value. So that is an element I think we should probably explore in terms of subsequent accounting for the goodwill. And just my experience in the past, in the French accounting standards, there was a special treatment for business transactions which were paid only or mostly in shares, whereby the internally generated goodwill of the entity that would reflect in the purchase goodwill would be offset against equity. Because that would go back to the previous situation where the internally generated goodwill is not recognized. I'm not sure this is the best outcome, the best solution, but I think that's something we should at least discuss if we were to go to some form of analysis of the components of goodwill.
On both timing, you know, which path do we take? What are Larry's questions about implication on timing and some of the things that Tom mentioned that also go on timing. Gary thought in terms of how long does different process have on getting to the effective date. I'm going to look at it a different way. I think about the conceptual framework where we did a discussion paper, and I think just about a year after the discussion paper was published an exposure draft. So, sprawling project, complicated issues, but I think that's an indication of how much time when it's a very high priority on a complicated project, going through that earlier, phase adds to the timeline. It's an example I throw out. And while I agree with some of the points that are made in support of moving directly to an exposure draft about, we've discussed a lot of these issues before, what would we be finding out? I think actually that they're being misdeployed when they're used that way, because I think our consideration of the feedback from each of our PIRs is actually not that people are raising new insights we didn't consider before, but rather saying you have, at least in the views of those participating in the PIR, you have misjudged what the costs and benefits were. And to me, when we talk about what we would be exploring in a PIR, I think it's less about how many different and new methods could we think about accounting for these things, but it's more about have we got the right and complete information. Now, Tom, you talked about feeling pressure, your organization, to make it an open discussion rather than going ahead on the basis of your 4-3 vote a while ago in terms of the amortization only or simplifications to impairment only or amortization plus simplifications to impairment. To me, that open discussion is what you do in a DP rather than what you do in an ED.
That's not what I said.
The actual vote was a vote to defer until we had clarity about what the ISB was
I had missed that.
We only deferred waiting for you.
Okay. Because when I look at the questions we face, the reason I think we
should go to a DP at the next step. Not ready to make a decision yet today, like many of the others here, but my gut to say, you know, go with an ED is not to think of how many more options are there, but I think what we said so far is our focus is, can we simplify the impairment? And if we do, how much of the pressure does it take off, and what's the interaction with the other decisions? And then the other thing that we need to explore is, why are we hearing that we misunderstood the costs and benefits in the package of decisions? I don't think it's to, you know, to explore lots of other alternatives, because I think one of the things we're faced with in our PIR responses are the people who responded in our, you know, to our outreach request and to our questionnaire expressing concerns had a majority view that was inconsistent with the research findings, you know, the literature reviews that were done about the relevance of some of this information that we're, you know, we're talking about possibly changing. And so I think we need to do something that engages a broader community in terms of, you know, did we get this balance wrong, and is it something? Or is it just an issue on which the world is always going to be divided 55-45, and we just keep re-deliberating it? And I don't want to rush out with a proposal that we then just end up backtracking from in terms of backing, you know, trying to step back and think about why are we getting this and what can we do with impairment that might take some of the pressure off. Somebody said, well, look at the FASB's qualitative screen, think about whether there are other simplifications, and think about the interactions of those. So, sorry, long-winded explanation of why I'm cautious in this area with just jumping to an ED.
Jim?
So I hear that piece, and you know, is it always going to be 50-50 or whatever the split is? I guess when I saw what you might explore in a DP, unless you heard some significantly different feedback than us, it seems actually counter to what we heard in the feedback, which was, you know, you're spending too much time on identifying intangibles, and in some cases they're not really economically separable. So to explore in a DP whether we could spend more time trying to economically separate the inseparable or to separate things that don't meet the definition of assets felt like, you know, we would be, at least just as one individual, a wasted year.
Yeah.
But if the DP explored, or some other outreach explored, you know, is there a way to build broader consensus around,
I was,
that would be more engaging to me.
I was arguing more for the vehicle than for the specific.
Gotcha.
Huh?
Well, just some general comments. First of all, I would like to say that if we ended up in vastly different places, it would be a really bad thing. And I suppose that you go for a reintroduction of amortization and we do not do that, then earnings would start to look very different on the basis of something that nobody really understands what it is and that most users take out and will continue, will then start taking out again. So I think that would be really a very bad thing. So if we can do, we have to do the utmost to prevent that, and you know, if that means that we have to try to speed up a little bit, I think we should seriously consider that, but we'll discuss that in a later meeting. It is also clear to me that whatever we do, there is no clear answer, and the fact that you were talking about 4-3 votes, that's not a very convincing start for a major overhaul of accounting. And I think we should also take that into consideration. Also, because this is a very new standard, the decision that was taken about goodwill was taken rather recently, and to drastically change that, and then you can be sure that that all of the people who have been relatively silent will start talking about, will tell us that we reach a completely wrong decision. So I think we have to be very careful. I am very susceptible to the cost argument, so I think, you know, the staff and the PIR identifies issues where we could really work towards reducing cost. But I would be very hesitant to, as we are so much blamed about overload of new regulation, overload of new standards, making changes to systems, etc.
I would just like to plead for caution here, also knowing that there are many other standards that that are also in urgent need of repair.
Stephen?
So I like Jim's phrase about building broader consensus, because I see this as such a controversial area. We have a lot of parties at the moment who are very vocal about reintroducing amortization. We go down that route and issue an ED, I'm sure we'll have a whole load of other people coming out equally vocal against it. I have a particular comment on Agenda Paper 13B, page 8, last paragraph, where the IASB staff is saying that you think we should look at the composition of goodwill and subsequent accounting before then thinking about impairment and simplifying impairment. I disagree. I think it's all connected, and I think the way the FASB has looked at it and the fact that they are considering either simplifying impairment or doing that plus amortization indicates that the two are connected. So I'd be very much against deferring the simplification of impairment consideration to after these things. I've got one question for the FASB. Those that support reintroducing amortization, is that a way of simplifying cost, or because you think conceptually it's the right answer?
The answer is, of course, both.
I'll
say it's conceptual.
I conceptually struggle whether goodwill meets the definition of an asset, but for something that says, and goodwill meets the definition of an asset, and so amortization seems the most effective way to get something that I don't think is an asset in the first place off the books in an easy way.
If I were, there's another argument, and that is that from a practical standpoint, much of goodwill that is left 5, 10 years after, 20 years after an acquisition, really isn't the goodwill related to that acquisition, but rather a replacement of goodwill that's been created subsequent to that acquisition. So effectively, you're indirectly, by not amortizing, capitalizing internally generated goodwill. And that would be part of the conceptual.
So part of the problem with the impairment model, it's a conceptual argument for me at times, is we have delayed impairment. And we have delayed impairment because we're taking internally developed goodwill and using it in the impairment test. I don't believe academic research at this point has said is impairment only is the best way to go.
Yeah.
It only says that impairment only has some information. It doesn't tell us anything whether amortization and impairment works. But I do think I went back and forth, Hans, in terms of whether I would be only impairment. You could see our vote is 7 says fix impairment. Yeah. And then there's 3 or 4 that are trying to struggle to go the other way. I would never support impairment amortization unless there was information to investors in that amortization about a period of recovery expected under the initial acquisition and potentially other than straight line amortization. If that were the case, I'm not sure that it would be reversed as often, but I'm also pretty sure that the constituents that are asking us to amortize have no interest in amortizing over a 3 to 5 to 7 year period other than straight line. And so that causes me great pause as to move to amortization, because if it was in play, my worry would be an arbitrary amortization over an extended period, which is meaningless in terms of any relevance of the information.
Very good.
If you are asked to vote or decide something, I will vote for the DP. You know, the reason is, I think the goodwill is slightly different from other issues. That is, it's a mix of cost complexity with end-date abuse side. You know, the reason why users view goodwill information are useless, I think, because two sides. One is the impairment is so complicated, therefore, preparers cannot do properly. Therefore, the result will not be useful.
And secondly, because of the abuse, you know, empirical research shows, you know, company try to recognize as less identified assets as possible, leave more amount to goodwill, and secondly, delay the impairment until the next takeover or next major changes of management. So these two parts mixed together make us difficult to find consensus. For example, in our constituencies, you know, some of them believe, you know, goodwill is good. Therefore, their suggestion is we should not appreciate amortization. Only do something, for example, simplify the impairment. On the other hand, you know, others will not agree with it. You know, they feel, you know, the anti-abuse is the most significant issue we have to consider. Therefore, they will feel, you know, amortization will be better than impairment, regardless whether you can improve or not. So I think these two things mixed together, you know, will make it hard to get consensus shortly. Therefore, I will support to start with DP.
I don't think you'll get a consensus in the long term either. That's
no.
We can.
And in answer to what Tom and Larry said, I can see the conceptual arguments for amortization. I do think there is an asset. I mean, if you would buy Apple, you would have to pay tremendous goodwill, and I think it's probably worth it. And I also think it's a wasting asset. So if we were to start with a blank sheet of paper, then I might be in favor of it, and I'm still undecided. But on the other hand, we all know that there is no good method to amortize it. That's also always arbitrary, that users find it worthless information. So why change? That's my ambivalence in this dossier. Whereas I think there is going to be a lot of benefit in looking at the impairment model and making that easy.
So it seems to me that there's work that both boards could do to make an improvement.
Yeah.
That I agree there's not a simple solution here. And it doesn't, I don't think the ISB is ready to decide between exposure draft and discussion paper, so there's no real point in raising the questions at this point. I do think that we should ask the teams to see if they can share information so you can have all the information that we've had, and we can also look at and potentially seek information from your PIR as to how well received your standard is without the step two impairment, to see if that's another path that we could consider. But we may have taken this as far as we can take it today.
That seems okay. Yeah, it was a very useful observation. Good. This is the end of our joint meeting. Thank you very much for coming over. I think we had a very good day.
Thank you for having us. I too thought it was a great day, and I think we all learned a lot from each other. And really, I observed that we seem to have some of the similar challenges.
Yeah.
So I think it's good to have this dialogue.
Okay, great.